Bodhisattva's vow. When I, student of the way, look at the real form of the universe, all is the never-failing manifestation of the mysterious truth of the awakened life. In any event, in any moment, and in any place, none can be other than the marvelous revelation of His glorious life. This realization made our ancestors and teachers extend tender care with respectful hearts even to such beings as birds and beasts. This realization teaches us that our daily food, drink, clothes, and protections of life are the warm flesh and blood, the merciful incarnation of the awakened life. Who can be ungrateful or not respectful, even to senseless things, not to speak of humans? Even though he may be a fool, be warm and compassionate toward him. If by any chance he should turn against us, become a sworn enemy, and abuse and persecute us, we should sincerely bow down with humble language in the reverent understanding that she is the merciful manifestation of the awakened life, which uses devices to emancipate us from blind tendencies produced and accumulated upon ourselves by our own egoistic delusion and attachment through countless cycles of space and time. Then, on each moment's flash of our thought, there will grow a lotus flower. And on each lotus flower will be revealed perfection, unceasingly manifest as our life, just as it is, right here and right now. May we extend this mind to all beings, so that we and the world together may attain maturity in the wisdom of the awakened life. Bodhisattva's vow is our basic practice vow. And in a way, everything that we do is a further manifestation of this. So the various forms of practice are reminders and supports of this Bodhisattva vow that there are many ways to articulate. Some of you know the four great vows that are done in many centers and traditions. That's another way to articulate this Bodhisattva's vow. In fact, it's known sometimes as the Bodhisattva's vow. Precepts we speak of as Bodhisattva precepts. So, three treasures, three pure precepts, 10 grave precepts are Bodhisattva precepts. The precepts that enable us, support us, remind us, encourage us to be the Bodhisattvas that we are. And when one takes the Bodhisattva precept in a form like Jukai or even Bodhisattva Shukei Tokudo, it's a further reinforcement of those precepts or another support for it. Or you could even say an indication of how much support we individually need and want. So it's important to know this. So tomorrow we're having Jukai for Heidi. A few days ago we had Shukei Tokudo, Bodhisattva Jukai, for Steve McCabe, Monshin. And it's important to know that what that is a support, a reminder, an externalization of what we are all doing. It's the same practice with added, if I say burdens, added forms to encourage and support us. Having Jukai or having a Raksu doesn't make one better than someone who doesn't. It's another way of manifesting the precepts, another way of making it public, the support, and also the public burden that we must live up to so we can hide less in self-centered habits and forget what our vow and practice is. Monshin and Shojo have been struggling with their robes this session, and you can see, in a way, having robes doesn't make one any better separate or anything. It just means that one's practice is always in one's face. Your practice and your requirement to practice is always right there. But please don't get caught in differentiating. This is exactly what we've been talking about, what I've been talking about throughout Sesshin. We've been talking about most intimate. What is this intimacy? This intimacy is the Bodhisattva practice, the vow of practice of never failing manifestation that is our life in any event, in any moment, and in any place. And yet, we all decide on places and events and moments when this isn't mine, this isn't the way it's supposed to be, this isn't what practice requires of me, they're bad, he shouldn't, she dare not, why this, why now? See? This is the practice, and this is why intimacy, though exactly this moment experiencing exactly our life, is exactly what we decide is not. And we explain it with all sorts of reasons and explain why it's a problem and it shouldn't be, and all this conceptual attachment, or call it self-centeredness, that blinds us to this moment, blinds us to the real form of our life. Real form of our life is, if I say stinky words, ongoing change, emptiness. The real form of our life is this realization of teachers and ancestors. When we say this realization made our ancestors and teachers extend tender care with respectful hearts even to such beings as birds and beasts, we're not talking about some birds and beasts out there. We're talking about the birds of prey that arise with our emotional reaction of anger or fear. That's the beast in our breast, if I use that kind of expression. The beast inside of us that we say, I shouldn't have that feeling, or that thought shouldn't be, or so on and so forth. What we refuse to extend tender care to states of mind and states of body. this fear is wrong. It's not my fault. I shouldn't have it. I need to do something. How dare them say that to me? How dare this happen to me? How dare I feel like this? See? We don't want to be respectful when feelings and thoughts and mind chatter and all sorts of other things arise, much less when others, so-called, do this. But that's exactly what this tender care How do we embrace all the various forms of life that arise as our life moment, neither grasping towards it nor pushing away? I mean, in a way, this is what our zazen requires of us all the time. Being this intimacy. Being intimate moment as is now. Giving ourselves away. And yet we discover ways we don't want to. See, it's easy to say, oh, it's our daily food and drink, when the food and drink is the way we want it, when the clothes and protections of life fit our image. But when the clothes and protections of life aren't the way we want them, when the food and drink and things that we hear and things that others say to us, or that we suspect they think of us, which is even worse, because we're very good at filling in all sorts of suspicions about what others must mean and intend. And it's very hard to embrace this as warm flesh and blood, merciful incarnation of awakened life, of Buddhas and ancestors incarnating right here to embrace us and allow us to embrace them in this moment. Breathing in, breathing out, and then responding. Instead, we are ungrateful, not respectful, much less angry and fighting. Senseless things and humans, not different. That's just our ideas and judgments. See, so this is the practice of intimacy. That's what Bodhisattva's vow is reminding us, and by articulating it, we remind ourselves and support ourselves and nurture ourselves in different ways. And still, sitting zazen, we can discover our habits of thoughts that we spin out about what the other person has done to me and what they must mean, and or and then you fill in what you want to do with that. See, so this is our practice. This is why intimacy means intimacy exactly here. This is why our practice is being just this. Just this is a whole universe coming together in this moment, whatever we think of it, whether it's the food we spilled and need to clean up, or the mess that we walk into and are sure it's someone else's fault and how dare them do this, or, and you could fill in the other ors. So, since this is the last Dharma talk and last chance for us to speak together about this, as some of you know, tomorrow we'll have a Jukai, and so we won't have the usual closing with your Dharma combat opportunity to come up and say, ask what you wish of me, and giving me an opportunity to expose myself instead will clarify a little more, because this is a time when your ongoing sesshin practice is rich. So I want you to make the best use of these next hours today and tomorrow, because in a sense we've been concentrating, in the sense of concentrating an elixir, making it richer and richer with our zazen. Of course, it's any moment, any place, every moment, and yet as we sit in sesshin, our ability to make practice effort is stronger. And of course, the beasts and the birds that arise in us, the raptors and blood, claw and tooth beasts that arise inside us can also be more intense, and therefore give us an opportunity to all the more manifest our bodhisattva life. Embrace the warm flesh and blood incarnated Buddha, incarnated awakened life that is the moment, breathing in, breathing out, arising, passing. Okay, I'm going to stop. And if you wish to explore this further, please do. And we can clarify our practice together. If you want to change positions, you are welcome to. Maybe first we should pass these bags. I have a slightly different translation here as well. As you know, or maybe you don't know, the Bodhisattva's vow was written by Torei Enji Zenji, who's a Dharma heir, considered the primary Dharma heir of Hakuin Zenji. So that's 17th century Japan. And the original translation was by Kazuki Sakeda, and further modified by Joko and myself. Just slight modifications in the English translation. Yes, sir.
Well, I was wondering if nothing is hidden, why do they refer to it as mysterious truth?
Mysterious in this case means dark, meaning it's not. One side is light, one side is dark. So mysterious is from the point of view of our conceptual thinking, it's mysterious. So we talk about the mysterious truth of the awakened life. Another form in the original would be mysterious truth of the Tathagata, the thus come, thus gone Buddha, the Buddha Nyorai, which is mysterious and yet all ways present, all revealed. See? All revealed, just as it is, right here, right now. And yet, to us, mysterious means dark, not mystery in the sense something that you can't, but it's in the sense of mysterious light and dark are two sides of the same. You know, that's the sense of mysterious. And it's mysterious in the sense that our concepts of trying to explain it and trying to make sense of it are inherently limited. Just as, if I use an analogy, I know you're someone who likes to spend time with cosmology. There's little, much of the cosmos is known by our electronic and visual spectrum and our studies of it. So there's the light parts of it. But at the same time, we also know there's all this dark part that's just equal part of penetrating all that light and penetrating all the cosmos, and yet we can't see it or see or have measurements of it. We can't directly access it. The two aren't too separate, and yet one is more easily accessible to us now, maybe not 100 years ago, and the other is there and yet dark to our ways of trying to understand it, our ways of trying to measure it. So in a sense you could say it's mysterious, in that the more you try to explain it and say about it and figure it out, the less you see it. So you should also know the word mysterious sometimes is also translated in wondrous, which is sort of just opposite, but that's at least the Chinese character that's being used in this case.
The Chinese character
that's being used as
mysterious.
Yes. In a way, we see it for ourselves that if we limit our zazen to what we think about our zazen, it becomes limited. The more we are willing to enter our zazen beyond how we figure it out, but just use whatever we so-called figure out or think or instruction, the more we use that to enter into our own life, the more we sense what we may not be able to say. And no need to say, because we simply live it. Does that make sense? If it makes sense, it's not. It's a little too explanatory.
It doesn't make sense. Sense that there's some something you can feel. I don't know. It's just not to me anyway. It's not logical. It's just when you see something, you see a bit of it.
Yes.
I was having trouble with that word, mysterious, also. And for me, I think it was Catholic background, 15 mysteries of the Rosary, all this. We grew up with this word that, to me, just meant doing anything and spending a lot of time saying Hail Marys over and over again. So as soon as I dropped all that, I can
in a way, mysteries isn't a bad word, except that if we don't have a trust in the mysteries, or if we have a reaction to it and no one helps us with it, then it becomes a hindrance. It becomes a hindrance. And it's very hard if one doesn't have a sense of it in their own practice life to transmit a trust, so that we can both hold a word like mysterious or mystery and not be repulsed or what's the word? Enchained by it. That's not a word, enchained. It's a different word needs to be used, but that's what I mean. So, it's just a word. Don't worry about it. One moment. It's very fortunate that your job in sitting Zazen isn't to come up with some way to explain it to anyone else or describe it. We just sit it. Just as our practice is being just this moment, but not then transcribing it and doing something further with it. It's in the practice of living our practice, our bodhisattva vow, that it's taken care of. Okay.
Okay. Well, it comes to me that mysterious, you always talk about Western interpretations of words. We think it's like, you know, Nancy Drew. It's a mystery. If we can figure it out, then it'll be clear to us.
Uh-huh.
Which reminds me of you telling me, I'm always too complicated, too much backstory. I want to give context and explain what's going on and what that person's motivated about, and how they could be feeling that way. And you're saying that's clouding it from just being present with the person.
Yes. Yes. And in a way, mystery, as Heidi said, is not just Eastern. I mean, she referred to Catholic tradition, which I don't know very much about, but she said something about the mystery of the rosary.
Mysteries
of the rosary, and then there's the mystery of a dark cloud of unknowing of St. John.
Yeah.
And there's many more like this. I mean, there's many aspects of this in the Jewish tradition, which I'm a little more familiar with. One of my teachers, when I was a troubled teenager trying to struggle and ask questions which I didn't get answers for, or the answers weren't adequate, and so on and so forth, one of my teachers said to me, I said, just do it and then it will become clear. You don't need an answer for this. Just do it. Unfortunately, I wasn't very receptive to that because I wanted some explanation. I wanted more answers to more questions. So, but really, it's a very good answer he gave me. He was very kind to give me that answer, though I had a hard time with that answer. But that was my difficulty. And we have, see, in a way, it takes great trust to sit Zazen, because you have to sit without getting any specific outcome, without getting any specifics that you want. You have to come to sit in trust in a way, the not knowing when that's there, to give yourself to the moment. So those who even come to Zazen often have tried all sorts of other things, and because the others don't satisfy, they are finally willing to put up with, I'll use the word someone used, the boredom of Zazen, the non answers or analysis in the direction that they wanted of Zazen, and yet to practice, to enter into just this moment, or just sitting, or breathing, or whatever your particular practice is. It takes a great amount of trust and confidence in your practice, in your willingness to do the practice, And it takes a great doubt of the all the ways that you've tried to explain and justify and manipulate, which have failed. So you've come to doubt that approach and that the answers that that gives.
When or what was the turning point for you?
Oh.
It's Zen.
No.
I mean, was it just because you were older?
No, I that's much too personal. I don't mean that it's personal that I want to hide it, but that's not the point. What it was for me, that's really, you know, the point is that in sitting, you begin to see that it's in the doing that we discover. It's in the exhausting the words and concepts approach for what's important that you begin to be willing to trust your own life and see what life requires. But more than that, it's not what my experience was. That's in a way secondary, because it doesn't mean anything. It's not a big deal. Each of us have our own stories, but what's important is clarifying how we can bring that together to our practice now, rather than entertaining us with old stories. I've written a little bit in the book. I wrote a little bit, but even more than that, you know, it's no big deal. It's in a way, it's our trust that when we sit, there is a richness to our life that we begin to taste for ourselves. And it's our own life, even if we don't put words to that richness or genuineness, because we can taste it, we can begin to trust ourselves. Then we can begin to clarify ways and what we need to do to practice. Then we begin to trust our practice. And that's why, as I said, what we are doing here now is clarifying. That's the only reason to talk about clarifying what and how to practice in our life, with the circumstances, so we can see for ourselves what's so. See, it's not about what someone else says, but it's about each moment's flash of our thought, of our life, see, to reveal our life as it is. That's our practice. And then, of course, in living our life with all beings, we extend and offer this in our interactions with others. Not that we go tell them, I've got this to tell you and that to tell you, but not that. We do it in our being and in our functioning with them, in our responding to the circumstances. That's what we call Bodhisattva's vow. To live the life of who and what we are. Or, as this starts out, the real form of this universe called our life. Our life is the life of the universe. Your life is the life of the universe. Nothing else. And yet, it's, if I use the expression, through the form and manifestations of you.
I don't know how many weeks ago it was, but you talked about this in one of the Sunday morning talks about Bodhisattva's vow, and the line that always stays with me. If I recite it or read it or hear you talk about it, is none can be other.
Yeah.
None can be other. And you know, for a whole host of life events, that reminder can be so helpful, but not in the way of, I don't know what to call this, but where you just have a positive outlook. But as a pointer to, you know, what's the practice as I see this as other.
Uh-huh.
That it's because I think it's possible for me to read that and it can sound like parts of it could sound like reflection on positive thinking.
Yeah.
But it's not that. It's when I find it helpful is when I look to see what is the thought spinning that I'm believing that this is other.
And what am I believing about this other, and therefore what is it I believe I should do or shouldn't do? It's not even believe, but how am I finding my reactions to this? Because much of this is the self-centered reactiveness is a habit that's faster than that. So what we discover is after we've been saying, doing, thinking, screaming, or whatever else. And other is fine. How do we bow down to this other? How do we respond appropriately to this other who's nothing but myself? See? And, or how are we refusing to do that? Or how are we being with this other who's screaming and yelling at me, who says hateful things to me or about me, or says hateful things to other people about me? Or who knows what else? And it doesn't make a difference if that hateful beast and rapacious, thank you, that's the word. I want to say a raptor bird, but rapacious bird is inside or outside, doesn't make a difference. Rapacious is a different word, it means wonderful, and you know, so rapacious, yes.
Another thing about how it's written at the very end, mm-hmm. when it says, it doesn't say, may we realize the awakened life, but it says, may we attain maturity
uh-huh.
in the awakened life, which sounds less
uh-huh.
either awake or you're not.
Uh-huh.
That, I don't know.
Another translation is, may we attain maturity in Buddha's wisdom, or in the wisdom of the Buddha, which is what that is saying. Maturity, meaning it's you, it's yours, it's who you are, and yet we need to mature. Which is, in a way, another way of saying that quote from Suzuki Roshi, you're perfect as you are, and you could use improvement. Or there's use for improvement or whatever. Yes.
Well, one of the things that I find useful, I do appreciate bodhisattvas as well.
Mm-hmm.
The blind tendencies,
uh-huh.
And where it says produced and accumulated upon ourselves by countless cycles,
uh-huh.
that sense of duration, but one thing that I noticed, because you mentioned about how sometimes during Sashin there's even a more of an intensity about
mm-hmm.
certain things, But lately, what I've been doing, my practice of walking,
mm-hmm.
I sometimes question when I start to feel anxious, what I could call anxious, if it's really fear or if it's something else. And then just to be able to stay in that. And sometimes I see that, well, wait a minute, this isn't fear. And that's a blind tendency that you think it's fear. It's like, no, this isn't fear, this is something else.
Yeah.
You know, and then just to, to the extent possible, allow that. But it's just interesting, even the little stories I tell myself about things. Not just about other people.
Yes.
But even about my own experience.
That's exactly it, yes. To be willing to go beyond our, reactive labeling and thought about it, and instead see, be, experience it, which we don't want to, because when we would rather call it, oh, this is fear, and therefore I have to do all this thing, which is therefore a way of avoiding experiencing it to any extent further. Yeah, good. And walking, all sorts of practices can support us in embracing, in being the intimacy of what's arising, what's appearing, what functioning life is at the moment for us. Thank you.